Hello and welcome to the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. I'm your host, Gary Gramling. I'll be joined by a special guest in just a moment. We are going to do a mailbag show next week, so if you want to send those questions in, you can send them into... You can actually send them. I will regret doing this, but you can send them directly to my email, and that is gary.gramling@si.com. I get all the talkback feedback there anyway now, so send them there, tweet them at us, Facebook them at us, and we'll get them. Please don't make me regret giving out that email address, but it's too late. And with that, I bring in for what's going to be a potpourri-type show. We have a couple of sort of random topics across the NFL that we're going to talk about, but our special guest this week, Andy Benoit. Andy, how's it going?
It's going very well. How about you, Gary?
Doing all right. Yeah, it's you know, we're sort of hot stove heating back up with Joe Flacco signing. We'll maybe talk about that for 14 seconds toward the end of the show. But what I want to do this week is just a couple, you know, it's a couple things that we kind of touched on over the last couple of months, but didn't really go that deep on. And I think they're really interesting questions or topics going into the 2020 NFL season now that we're, we are kind of set with what we have. And obviously there are going to be complications with the pandemic and you know, when teams can get into workout and that sort of thing. But these are kind of bigger themes that are going to very much affect how the season will play out.
And the Flacco one really has me excited.
Yeah. Yeah. As everyone in New York is.
I was a big Flacco guy initially. I've cooled on him in recent years because he hasn't been the same player. But he was one of the more, at his height and his prime, he was kind of one of the more polarizing quarterbacks in the NFL. He's almost like a Mendoza line for a lot of different discussions about quarterbacks.
Yeah, I mean, look, he was, I think, maybe slightly better than he got credit for in Baltimore. I mean, that team's identity was so overwhelmingly the defense that he never quite got full credit for that. And, you know, obviously he had the knee injury. And like you said, he was, whether it was the injury or whether he was just kind of exposed, in different systems, he just wasn't very good the last couple of years.
Yeah, he wasn't the same player, and his poise in the pocket really took a hit, and that is one where you wonder how the knee injury may have factored in. We can talk more about him later, though, and maybe the Jets offense as a whole. But yeah, I guess I'll let you go back to leading and hosting the show here.
Yeah, I was going to say we'll save the last now 3 seconds of the Flacco discussion for the end of the show. We'll also talk about the this 4th and 15. Instead of onside kick rule proposal, and we will fire off some just heated takes on that. But we have four things to talk about, four of the contenders across the league, and we're going to start with Tennessee. And this kind of ties into, it'll tie into a lot of teams, but I think one team that we mentioned during our draft recap shows that this will sort of link to a little bit going forward. This Titans wide zone offense, it worked so well in the second half of last year. You saw not only the run game work, but they had a quarterback in Ryan Tannehill who just absolutely took off and looked like a new player operating it. We see in Green Bay, you know, they don't add weapons. They do add A.J. Dillon. It's Matt LaFleur there who ran that wide zone in Tennessee the previous year. I would ask you this, Andy. Number one, why is the wide zone sort of coming back into vogue? Why isn't it an effective rushing attack? And number two, this system, how easy is it to replicate?
Well, that's a great discussion. It's part of the reason it's coming back in vogue is because all the young offensive coaches, McVay, Shanahan, LaFleur especially, that's their foundation. So it's the Mike Shanahan approach. And there's a lot of benefits to it, Gary. I think let's understand the premise of it first and foremost. These guys will tell you, if you ask LaFleur or McVay or Shanahan, at some point you'll hear the phrase very early in the discussion, you'll hear them say, plays that start out looking the same but are different. And the premise of the outside zone, the wide zone, same thing, is that every play looks the same for the first 1.5 seconds into the play, which now we're talking about getting into the play action game and how you build your run fakes off of your actual run plays. And it really puts a lot of emphasis on the play caller, because you're not just calling one play at a time. You're almost calling plays in packages. You're calling plays to set up other plays, to set up other plays, and you can really manipulate the narrative and flow of the game that way. So it's a play caller. If you're a smart play caller, it's a play caller's dream. And the other thing that they do in the wide zone, and the Niners are the best at it, but it's other teams can do it. They understand that there are certain run gap rules you have to play as a defense. You have to defend the gaps. You cannot leave a run gap undefended. No defense will do that. You give up 10 yards automatically if you do most of the time. So under the premise of, okay, well, they have to defend the run gaps, we now know where the front seven defenders and the strong safety are going to be. So let's attack those guys because we know where they're going to be. And the Niners, what they do so well is add gaps to the equation by bringing in a fullback or using, they actually use pull blockers this year, which it really is not technically wide zone at all, but it comes from the same mindset. Make them have to defend the run, give them more run options to defend, and that gives them fewer options in coverage, and they're predictable at linebacker and safety the whole time, and that's who we attack. That's why all these teams, the Rams are great at, the Niners, they're always running in-breaking routes, because that's where those routes go when they attack linebackers.
I was going to say, I want to get back to Tannehill and the effect on quarterbacks in a second, but we saw that 49ers rushing attack against the Packers in the NFC title game. I mean, they basically got whatever they wanted, and then Shanahan kind of said after the game, it was just those huge rushing plays were just available for them. They could see they were there. I mean, is that just a matter of Shanahan drawing up a little bit differently, or is this something you can kind of... I don't know, you can kind of rely on a little bit more to pick up a couple of chunk plays as opposed to, you know, maybe you have a quarterback you don't completely trust and you don't want to put the ball in any kind of danger.
Well, yeah, that's a good point as well. And remember, all this makes life on the quarterback easier. When your run game's going well, we've known that for 1,000 years, that helps your quarterback. And when you can throw the ball on first or second down, as opposed to obvious pass situations on third down, that also helps your quarterback. Less man coverage on first and second down, certainly less blitzing, less disguise. It's just easier for everybody. As far as scheming the running game and how they do it and how they were successful against Green Bay, it's a very academic approach there in San Francisco. And Shanahan has a really good staff, and they're all almost... In their 30s, late 30s, mid 30s, some are early 30s. It's a young staff that sees the game from a strategic standpoint. And Mike McDaniel's one guy in particular. He's their run game coordinator. And when they talk about the running game there, you never hear about, oh, established attitude and, you know, I got to put them in the dirt. And, you know, I'm sure there's some of that when they're actually executing and practicing, but they're not an old fashioned black and blue mindset as a run team. They view that as a strategic element of the game, just like the passing game would be. And they do a lot of stuff with it. So the Green Bay, they got a beat on those guys, and they probably... My guess, I don't know this. I wish I'd asked them when I saw these guys at the combine. They probably realize that Green Bay is going to do a certain few things in against certain formations, and we can manipulate them that way. Whatever it was, they got what they wanted with Green Bay for sure. It's the new age, Gary. It's and really what we're talking about is just coaches who are smarter than certain other coaches. And I'm not saying that about Shanahan and Mike Pettine in this example, just in the broad scheme of things, smart coaching is taking on a greater emphasis in the NFL now because of the way run game and pass game are getting married.
Yeah, and you know, I was going to say, we've talked about on the show for a couple of years how there's no real need to quote-unquote establish the run early in the game, that defenses will react to the play-action stuff no matter what you've done so far in the game, that they're not going to ignore what looks like a run play to them. It is going to suck linebackers up to an extent. I wonder with Derrick Henry and especially with big backs like that, and I would put A.J. Dillon in that, basically guys who you don't want to let them get that runway. It's guys who you want to get to early in the down. So I wonder if stylistically, while the Titans don't need to necessarily establish the run to get the play action going, everyone knows what they are. Everyone knows who Derrick Henry is. And if you are going to be effective tackling Derrick Henry, you want to get to him earlier in the down rather than later. So maybe you are sucking up even harder with your linebackers. That's an ugly phrase right there, sucking up even harder. But they are getting sucked up even more aggressively than they would against, you know, sort of generic back X.
Yeah, I think that's fair, because your plan as a defense cannot just be for a defensive lineman, go get penetration. I mean, you would love that, but that can't be your plan. You can't just hope that your guys are going to execute better. You, as a unit, have to have an approach, a collective approach for taking on, in this case, in your example, a really good running game like Derrick Henry and the Titans have. And your point about the play action, that's a great point, that you don't need to establish a run to do play action. And that's another benefit of this wide zone scheme, is the nature of the scheme already establishes the run itself. Because if every play starts out looking the same, but they might be different, they will be different, but they all look the same, what are you going to do? Just not react to what you see from that play initially? You have to react to the run blocking motion regardless, because the play is all flowing in one direction. So your defense is going to flow with it. So the run game is established by design in these newer age offenses and these wide zone schemes, especially. And that makes it even easier to throw the ball on first and second down. As far as Derrick Henry, I agree with you. Yeah, that's a guy, you cannot give him a head of steam. So what do we do about that? The closest thing I think you could do to scheming it differently, if you wanted to try to just clog the field for a Derrick Henry type of guy, the Bengals did this last year, because they were really struggling, not against Tennessee, but overall. They were really struggling in run defense, so they started playing with five defensive linemen. They put five guys up front, all D linemen. It wasn't a strong side linebacker walking up on the edges like you get. It was five defensive linemen, and we're going to control the front, or at least make more bodies for you to have to deal with up there. Even if the offense wins, offensive linemen are not going to drive defensive linemen 5 yards off the ball very often. So it's still, in theory, I think it still could clog something for a guy like Derrick Henry. All you want to do is not let him get his momentum up. Even if he's gaining 2 or 3 yards, but he's not running full speed, you can tackle Derrick Henry when he's running at half his regular speed. You can bring him down in that scenario.
Well, I was going to say, we saw in Super Bowl 53, the Patriots put six players on the defensive line of scrimmage, and that sort of took away the Rams outside zone runs there. Should we have seen more of that last year, or is that just something that you need to be sort of as versatile as the Patriots with your personnel to be able to do?
No, any team can do that. The Saints did that against the Rams in Week 2. And the Rams had gone all offseason knowing that we're going to see this from a lot of people now. Because the Patriots really gave them trouble in the run game with that 6-1 front you're talking about. So in Week 2, what the Rams did was their wide receivers always line up so tight to the formation. They had those receivers crack block the defensive end, and then they just pulled the tackle around. So they basically ran sweeps and ran around the 6-man defensive line, and they used the receivers to pin the edge defenders back inside. And it worked brilliantly. They dominated the Saints with that. And just like that, those 6-1 fronts weren't there every week anymore. They were still there some, but they weren't there the way that teams were planning on putting it there. So the guy that wins schematically is the guy who has the pen last. That's what coaches always say. And that's why the game continues to evolve again and again.
All right, Chapter 2 of this show. You mentioned Mike Pettine a little bit earlier, and I want to talk about specifically Pettine and the Packers defense. Obviously, we've talked a ton over the last couple of weeks about Jordan Love and Aaron Rodgers and what the Packers are going to be offensively going forward. The defense is really interesting to me, because look, I thought they were kind of a year ahead of where I thought they would be. Preston Smith and Za'Darius Smith ended up being excellent additions. They were really young in the secondary, though, and both safeties were new. They had Adrian Amos, who's a veteran, but Darnell Savage, they were playing a rookie. They're still young at cornerback. I thought they were ahead, considering how complex Pettine and his scheme are. And by the end of the year, they ended with a complete meltdown in the NFC title game, and all of a sudden people are calling for Pettine's head. If the offense is sort of a question mark in Green Bay more than it's been in past years, can this team sort of take on a defense centric identity and sort of be a potentially dominant unit here.
Well, I would argue that's their identity last year already. They weren't a dominant unit, but what you're saying is valid. They were a better unit than people expected. The Green Bay Packers overall, they're a work in progress as a team, and I mean that in a complimentary way. I mean, they went 13-3 as a work in progress, but they very well as a unit or as a whole unit, as an organization, they very well this year could improve 15 or 20% and go 11-5. I mean, it's just the way the games unfold sometimes. I think they'll be a better team this season, regardless of what their record ends up saying. Obviously, they go 8-8. I'm not going to be correct, but I don't know if they have to go 13-3 to have them be progressing this year because of where they are offensively and defensively. Those are two very distinct schemes that they have. I'm looking up there now. They both where would you guess those units both ranked the same in terms of yards, Gary? Where would you guess they ranked in the NFL?
I will say 8.
Add 10 to that and you'd be correct.
Really?
18th. Wow. So a team that ranked 18th in defense and offense in terms of yards, which is not a great metric to use, but it's one that everyone's for some reason always agreed on. The 18th ranked offense and defense in the NFL went 13-3 and reached the NFC Championship, which tells you two things. One is that team won situationally a lot, and they took advantage of situations and they managed the game well. And then two, it's really stupid to rank teams by yardage allowed and yardage gained. But the point is, it's a defense trending upward. It's an offense trending up as well, but that defense that we're talking about, after 2018, I came away honestly thinking, you know, I don't know if I love the Packers defense. I've always loved Mike Pettine as a coach. I've never met him, but I've always loved what his approach has been about and how his team approaches the game on film. The problem I had in 2018 was they did a lot of different stuff and they played guys in different positions every week, it felt like, especially in the secondary. And maybe part of me just resents that because it makes it longer to watch film if you're not on the inside. But I didn't think anyone was very good at everything. So they did a lot of stuff, but they didn't do anything particularly well. And I had kind of soured on the whole approach. Well, it takes a little time to do a lot of things well. And last year, for one, I think Pettine did rotate guys a little bit less. There were more defined roles, but they were still a versatile unit. And then number two is guys played better in year two under Pettine, which is a good commentary on him. So I'm optimistic for the defense. And I didn't think Za'Darius and Preston Smith were going to be nearly as good. Za'Darius, I was pretty high on. Preston Smith, I wasn't. I didn't think neither would be great because they fit the profile, the Paul Kruger profile, big free agent who's really just a good player, not great player. But those guys became great players last year. They got a lot better.
And by the way, the Packers actually led the NFL in points above expected in red zone offense and defense.
So what's that mean? They got in the red zone and did better than people? They just were good in the red zone? Is that what you're saying?
If you expect every team, because the sample size is so small, if you expect every team to be right around the league average, which is obviously not going to happen, but right at the league average for points per red zone possession, they were basically they were way ahead in offense, and they defensively gave up far fewer points in the red zone than others.
That's interesting. That's very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, 44.3 points on the season.
One thing I know they did in the red zone defensively is they would play one high safety, which very rarely anybody does that because the point of playing one high safety is to patrol the deep middle of the field. And in the red zone, there really is not a deep middle of the field, especially as you get into the tight red zone. But they played man and zone match concepts out of it, and they were a little hard to decipher at times. So just a subtly different red zone. I'm not saying they did that every snap, but I have distinct plays in my mind right now where they had one safety back deep, and they were a little bit different than other teams there. The Seahawks used to do that with Earl Thomas in the red zone.
All right, chapter three here, Andy. Let's keep it in the NFC contenders, defending NFC champions, obviously. Let's talk about Jimmy Garoppolo just a little bit. I mean, look, the narrative coming out of the Super Bowl was getting completely out of control. I know people were calling for his head because he overshot. Who do you overshoot on that late play there that would have been the touchdown? That was Emmanuel Sanders. And, you know, he was like, oh, Jimmy Garoppolo can't make the big throw in the Super Bowl. If you went back over the years and looked at Super Bowl performances, you would find many that were much worse than Jimmy Garoppolo and many by quarterbacks who are much better than Jimmy Garoppolo who have gone on to Hall of Fame type careers. I would say if the first time you ever saw Ben Roethlisberger was Super Bowl 40, you would have immediately concluded that he could not play football in the NFL. Mm-hmm. Now, that said, Garoppolo was really uneven all season, and you wonder if mechanically coming off the ACL injury that was affecting him, he just ball placement was off, and he was often high and wide with ball placement, which is even more problematic. But it's a quarterback friendly offense. He had some moments. He had some rocky moments as well. I mean, look, he came back and won a game in New Orleans, a shootout, and he had some games that he just didn't play very well. And I would even argue in his, basically throwing the ball in those two playoff games, the win over the Vikings and the win over the Packers, he was not very sharp. But, is this an issue going forward for him, or did it look to you more like guy coming off an injury, working deeper into the season than he has in the past? It's just a matter of sharpening up.
Well, I think I like Garoppolo, and I do think for his level of talent as a passer, which is considerable because he has a quick, fast release, and he can throw from different platforms. He does not have to necessarily be set in order to throw. I'm not saying he's Aaron Rodgers like that, but he's by no means a statue as a pocket passer. For a guy with that kind of talent, he does miss too many throws. He is inaccurate a handful of times every game, and that doesn't quite add up. And maybe a Shane Day, their QB coach here in San Francisco, might be able to explain, well, yeah, it's this, this, and this with his mechanics or very small things. I don't know. His mechanics to me look, it's not like Cam Newton where it's a different kind of throwing motion. You just understand, okay, this is going to be plus and minus results, and we're going to trust that the pluses are going to be huge. Garoppolo has the type of throwing ability that should be leading itself to 67% completion rates. And actually, I'm looking now, 60 completion rates, actually 69.1 last year. It's some of the throws that he misses shouldn't be missed. It's those, 30.9% of the throws that are incomplete. About 50% of those could have been different, I think, or at least, a handful of them. So that's the Garoppolo story. But Kyle Shanahan made an interesting point after the Super Bowl, Gary. He said, well, he was probably 10 minutes, I don't know exactly what Shanahan said, but it was to the effect of he was probably about 10 minutes away, Garoppolo, from being named Super Bowl MVP. If they'd won that game, that's probably who the voters would have given it to. So the narrative and perception on him, that's really what this discussion is about if we're going to put it just on the Super Bowl. Garoppolo did not have his best day on the Super Bowl, but I'm with you. I don't think that was the reason they lost that game. So it'll be interesting to see what happens next year. But they didn't really make an effort to replace him this offseason, and they probably could have if they wanted to.
Yeah, the interesting thing about Garoppolo, I would argue that he did have a lot of off-target throws that receivers made plays on. At the same time, I think he was near the top in receiver drop rate. So it's almost like that entire passing game was sort of they made some difficult plays look easy, and they made some easy plays look difficult. And I don't know. I guess it kind of maybe evened out in the end. But
well, and one quick note on those receiver drop rates. Those are very subjective because a lot of times the ball is dropped when the quarterback's 5% wrong on a throw, or he's glitched just enough. Sometimes the guy just drops the ball, certainly. But usually there's always a second factor. Was there a penetration? Did something flash in front of the receiver's face? The drop rates don't always tell the entire story.
Fair enough.
I'm not getting on you, though. Like your point's a good one still. I'm not saying they mean nothing. But I bet you Garoppolo on some of those drops would say, I could have been a little better on that throw.
My point is the world is chaos. And everything is meaningless.
Okay.
we have no idea. Is Jimmy Garoppolo good or bad? We just shrug our shoulders. I think it'll be better this year. Last chapter here, the first part, before we revisit the red-hot Joe Flacco headline here. So I want to talk about two guys in the AFC, non-playoff teams last year. I think one team has optimism around them, the other maybe not so much, although maybe they should have more optimism. The Steelers and the Jets, and these are reports coming from beat reporters Ed Bouchette of The Athletic and Rich Samini of ESPN. Two guys, Juju Smith-Schuster and Marcus May, they are in their last year of their rookie deals. And both reports are that the teams will not give them a second contract, that they are both going to be on the open market next offseason. So I do want to touch on both those guys. We'll start with May. Mm-hmm. And the Jets, I mean, look, we're not getting into Jamal Adams rumors right now. I mean, it's a long offseason, and they still have plenty of time to get something done with him. But May is kind of the other guy there, and he's been pretty solid. He is not Jamal Adams. He is not that level of player, but he's been a pretty solid safety for them over his first three seasons here. You've kind of pegged him as a guy who is, you know, not good enough to get franchise tagged, but, you know, the kind of guy who does hit the open market and probably get paid pretty well on it.
Yeah, I could see him going that way. I do think, I don't think he's an elite safety by any stretch, but he's a quality starting NFL safety. The people making these decisions in New York, it's GM Joe Douglas, and I imagine that he gets considerable input from his coaching staff, which means the scheme is driving some of the personnel decisions. And in New York's case on defense, the scheme is a lot. And when you talk about defensive scheme, you start with our third down approach, because that's really where games are won and lost, is what's your passing down approach. Everyone's run defense is relatively the same, which is another reason those wide zones work so well. That's back to the predictability. But what's your pass defense philosophy? The Jets' pass defense philosophy is to play cover two deep safeties back. And you might think, well, that means, you know, maybe you need two safeties in. It doesn't go that way. Cover two really hides your cornerbacks, and it hides your safeties to some degree as well. Those guys all kind of help each other. It's a collective effort, and you're not asking them to win one-on-one against receivers and tight ends. So if that's your approach, then you don't want to be investing at the cornerback or safety position. You really can't afford to. Look at the teams that do pay multiple safeties. The Ravens are one. They play a ton of man coverage and a ton of fire zone, which for a safety basically often becomes man coverage. The Vikings for years, and actually they're doing it this year, Harrison Smith and Anthony Harris. That's a lot of money at the safety position. Well, they play a lot of cover four, where the safeties basically have the inner fourth of the field, and it plays out like man coverage down there. If your safeties are not good, your cover four scheme's not going to work. So the teams that pay safeties, that pay both safety positions, they're teams that run schemes that highlight the safeties. Back to our conversation a few weeks ago, there was a coach years ago that told me, in our system, I just view the safety as an insurance policy. And this coach was dropping his defensive lineman back to center field at times on some super disguised coverages. And I said, well, how do you do that? So if they ever throw the ball to our defensive lineman in center field, we're screwed. There's no question about it. But we're banking on the idea that our pressure and what we're doing will prevent them from throwing that, and we're taking out a cheaper insurance policy at the safety position. So some teams don't value safeties at all. Others value it a lot. The Jets would fall closer to the not value it at all side. They do value it. They're going to try to keep Jamal Adams, but it's not a hallmark position in their scheme. Pass rushers would be. So that's where they're going to invest.
All right, and Juju Smith-Schuster. I mean, look, this time last year, we were all sort of, you know, looking at him as you know, a budding superstar. And now all of a sudden, he has this really injury plague 2019. On top of that, Roethlisberger goes down early in the year, and the Steelers have all sorts of issues under center with their quarterbacks there. I don't know. I mean, look, he's a youngish guy. I do kind of wonder what interest there is on him. I mean, he'll obviously have interest on the open market, but you know, does he get paid as a number one, and should he get paid by a number one as a number one?
Well, I think he's a lower end number one if we're just talking dollars and cents in that conversation. At least if I'm a team wanting to sign him, and I imagine there would be a lot of teams that would want to sign him. That's where the conversation would begin. We would say he's not quite Stephon Diggs, but he's better than, I don't know, who's a receiver that got paid this offseason, Gary? Probably nobody.
Robbie Anderson?
Yeah, that's actually a great one. He's better than Robbie Anderson. He's not quite as good as Stephon Diggs. That's where the conversation would begin. And Smith-Schuster's people would say, well, his numbers went down last year because the whole offense went down because they didn't have their quarterback situation stable at all. And those quarterbacks really, really struggled, and the passing game just wasn't there. And they didn't have a guy opposite Smith-Schuster, so the coverages were focused on him a little differently. And they'd go back and forth, and that's the whole discussion. Here's the part for me, Gary. I'm surprised that discussion is even possibly going to take place. I would have thought the Steelers would absolutely want to re-sign Smith-Schuster, or in the very least, franchise tag him and see how he bounces back now that Roethlisberger's back and now that he's healthy. You wonder, and I actually looked up because Ed Bouchette has been around a long time. He's got his pulse on that Steeler organization. That's a credible source saying that. So then you wonder, all right, why is the guy potentially available? Or why would he not be re-signed? Who told Bouchette that, and what was the reason for telling him that? Because I can't think of a good one. Smith-Schuster, you don't let guys like that out the building. That guy was a top 10 receiver 2 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's just kind of going down that trend of sort of not paying receivers or not sort of paying receivers as top-end guys.
Well,
and look, we saw... I'll let you get into it, but we saw last offseason... We had a couple of receivers out there who just didn't get paid like we thought they'd get paid, and a lot of people just pointed to the draft and said, well, we can lock these guys in for 4 years at a really cheap deal, so we'll roll the dice there. I mentioned a couple weeks ago the 2021 receiver class in that draft is looking to be as good, if not better, than the 2020 draft. So I do wonder if there are teams with an eye toward that. On top of that... And I'll pose this to you. I thought James Washington flashed last year. He's still not consistent, but yeah. I thought it was an encouraging year for them. And when they took Chase Claypool in round two, look, I didn't think Claypool is a guy who's like, okay, Smith-Schuster's done, might as well move on. But I think Claypool is a guy you can turn into a big slot, and then you keep Washington on the outside. Deontay Johnson's kind of a gadgety type of guy to mix in there. And that's a pretty good-looking unit. So are you going to spend top dollar on Smith-Schuster?
Yeah, and that's maybe fair. That very well could be what they're thinking. And I thought Washington was better last year. I thought Deontay Johnson got better as the season went along. I still think neither of those guys are surefire starters yet. They need to be much more consistent than they have been. And we'll see. And if both those guys play well, you know, I wouldn't have guessed that Smith-Schuster would be in such a shining light in my mind a few years ago because he was a third-round pick. So it's entirely possible. I'll tell you this, Juju Smith-Schuster, when Roethlisberger was throwing in the ball, he was as effective as almost any receiver in the NFL. And that's important to keep in mind. If Roethlisberger's here, I can't imagine Roethlisberger would not want Smith-Schuster available for him.
No, that's gonna be a big storyline if it does hold up this going into next offseason. But we'll see what kind of year he has, and the Steelers can certainly change their minds between now and then if in fact they are leaning that way.
Well, the part to keep in mind, you wonder why this news got to Bouchette still. Did somebody from Pittsburgh want Smith-Schuster to hear it? Do they feel like he needs to be motivated like that? Are there locker room issues? We don't know any of this stuff, but if you're a team, and maybe it's as simple as Bouchette found it out somehow, and what you described is the scenario. It's just a function of economics, but these are the questions teams are asking about Smith-Schuster right now.
Let's get to the big one here. Joe Flacco is a New York Jet. He will back up Sam Darnold. And look, Darnold missed a lot of time last year, and the Jets were probably pretty bummed that Luke Falk was getting a lot of snaps for them. But I don't know. I mean, it seems like it's over for Flacco. It seems like he is not a starter ever again. And this is what he is. He's going to sort of bounce around the league as a number two quarterback.
Which I think that's fine. He's a good number two quarterback because he's been there before. He's done everything that any starter in the NFL has done so far. He's had every experience, I mean. So that was the problem with the Jets. A head coach told me not too long ago, Gary, that the worst thing that could ever happen for a backup quarterback is you have to play. Because then, as Gary Kubiak said, when they asked Kubiak, oh, you, does it bother you that you'd never played behind Elway? He said, well, no, because then they would have found out I couldn't play and I wouldn't get to be there at all anymore. So, you know, not there are not 32 quality backups in the NFL. There might not even be 8 quality backups in the NFL. Yeah. The Jets found that out the hard way last year. At least with Flacco, you can still run probably your whole offense.
All right. And the other one we got, this is a proposed rule. It's sort of come up a little bit in the past, and now it's being considered. Basically replacing the onside kick. Teams would have the option twice a game instead of attempting an onside kick to retain possession after a scoring drive. They would have a 4th-and-15 situation at their own 25. If they don't get the 15 yards, then the opponent would take over at the spot of the ball there. But yeah, 4th-and-15. I think it makes a ton of sense. We saw with the new onside kick rules, which were put in for player safety concerns, they have made onside kicks so difficult to recover that it's not an interesting play anymore.
Right.
It's probably not a play that's really worth it until absolute desperation at that point. So, I'm looking here. 16.3% last season, but that was a big uptick. It was 10.5% since the new rules went in 2018. So, this 4th-and-15, we had teams on 3rd-and-15 and 4th-and-15. This is according to Pro Football Talk. Were successful 15.9% of the time last season. So, you're looking at a 16% play. Obviously, some teams are going to convert that more often because their quarterbacks and their offenses are better. But overall, Andy, fire off your take.
My take is I love the idea, and regardless of what the stats for onside kick recovery would be, I think they ought to implement this. And my reason for the take is kickers are getting paid. The good ones are getting paid $3, maybe $4 million a year. Justin Tucker's the best. He gets paid $5 million a year. And your quarterbacks are making $25 to $30 million a year. So those 4th-and-15 plays or those onside kick plays, those are coming at critical junctures in the game. If you're a football team, who do you want to be relying on in that instant?
Yeah, it's it's a total crapshoot play. It's not, you know, I don't want to say it's not a football play. It does involve
some sort of planning. You're talking
about the onside kick. Yeah, the onside kick, sorry. Yeah, it's just, you know, it's a dart throw. It, you know, you plan for it to an extent, but yeah, it doesn't really.
Yeah, no, I don't like the bounce of the ball. You know, lucky. I don't like any of that stuff. I want the people who out scheme the other people and the players who out scheme the other players. That's who I want winning the games. So I don't like it when this stuff comes down to kickers. Field goals, I understand. That's fine. That's a field position thing, and you need your kicker. And if I get that. Extra points, I told you a few years ago, get rid of them. Make touchdowns automatically 7. You can go for 8 if you want. If you don't get it, then the touchdowns were 6. I think kickers, if you can replace kickers with quarterbacks and the plays are 4th down or plays for points, that to me is an absolute no-brainer in a league that's built around the quarterback.
Yeah, and look, when they pushed the extra point back, it was supposed to be this whole like, ooh, it's going to make the extra point interesting.
Nope.
And there are more missed extra points, but it's still not an interesting play.
Correct. Yeah, and it's all it is frustrating then, because a touchdown needs to be worth more than 2 field goals. Otherwise, to some degree, you're incentivizing field goals. So I don't find any of those extra point plays interesting in the least bit. Unless they get return, like a block, like I guess what, an interception return can be 2 points for the defense now on a 2-point play. I do like that. That's the one spot college football was better than the NFL at for a lot of years. But Gary, and I'll tell you this. I've admitted to coaches, just like I admit to our listeners and to you, that I don't follow special teams, not because I don't respect it, even though it sounds like I don't, I'm sure, right here. It's just not time to follow it and keep up with all the offense and defense. There's just not time. And the head coaches I've told that I have had some, and some are big name head coaches that have said, yeah, I'm the same way. I don't follow special teams. I mean, I'm aware of it. I know about it, but I just want our guys to, if we can break even on special teams, I'm all for that. There are some that would say, well, Bill Belichick's attitude is very different, and how's that gone for him? The point is, quarterbacks over kickers. That's the broad point. and offense over special teams, defense over special teams.
I like it. I like that you arrived at a campaign slogan too.
Yeah. But, cool. Well, if you get the second attempt, the kickers, quarterbacks over kickers, that's not a great bumper sticker. But if we can get it down to just quarterbacks over kickers, that could work.
Yeah, there we go. Youngway Koo single-handedly sort of skewed those onside kick numbers last year too. And I don't know if you would look at the Falcons and say, like, boy, they got a real weapon there, Youngway Koo with his onside kicks. What a smart addition to the roster that they made halfway through the season. But to me, it's not only all the stuff we just said, but also the whole point of changing the onside kick was for player safety. And you improve player safety even more if you go to the 4th and 15 play. So yeah. why not do it? I wouldn't mind if they did away with kickoffs overall and came up with some way to do this, whether you have an option to punt or go for it coming off of a scoring drive. So
yeah.
All right, Andy, that's going to do it for now. We will have the mailbag next week. If indeed Andy is our special guest, well, you'll have to tune in and see who it is. It might just be, I don't know, me and Shelby sort of mumbling through a show and trying to do an Andy impression. So send those questions in. Again, you can send it straight to my email, gary.gramling@si.com, or you can tweet at us. You can Facebook us or Instagram us or whatever.
Are you on Instagram?
I don't like any of the social media channels. I participate minimally in Twitter. Facebook and Instagram I hate.
Okay. I'm not on Instagram. And I get frustrated because I click on it and you can only scroll so far. And then it says, oh, got to sign up. Can't look in here unless you're signed up. And that's when I go back. And then I wish I'd gotten those 2 minutes back.
We need a self-contained social media channel. Anti-social media channel, I guess it would be. Just me and you and anyone who wants to send us a question.
Well, years ago, people had conversations with each other. And those conversations were not broadcast for everybody either. They didn't have an audience judging you the whole time. It was just you and the guy talking. So if you ever want to talk, I'm all for that.
That seems a little bit weird. Yeah. Seems a little bit hermitish.
Yeah, too vulnerable. Too vulnerable for me.
Andy, I will talk to you in a minimum of exactly 1 week.
Okay, thanks, Gary.
The MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast is me, Gary Gramling. Special thanks to Andy Benoit for joining us for this one. We are produced by Shelby Royston. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody. Ben Eagle, new dad Ben Eagle, is director of editorial projects and product. Mark Ravick is emeritus editor of the MMQB. Andy Benoit is the founder of the MMQB NFL Podcast. Keep up with our entire lineup of podcasts 5 days a week by subscribing to the MMQB NFL Podcast for free on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, please do us a favor and leave a rating and review. It really does help other people find the show, which is also available on Spotify, radio.com, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.